Pace v. Toyota, 06-16-10. Back to automobiles.
Yes, Your Honor.
The hybrid case.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And may it please the court. This is a case where the jury below found that there was no literal infringement and found 8 out of the 10 claims not infringed under equivalency. And we appeal. The problem was is that counsel, after the literal case, made what we think is an invitation for an improper compromise. And in response to that, the jury found 2 claims. They hooked us on equivalence. And Your Honor, there's no support for that portion of the verdict. It is fundamental, of course, that the doctrine of equivalence, literal infringement, are separate doctrines. You can have some evidence that relates to both, but you have to link it up. You have to put it in a separate framework and present it to the jury as a different issue. You cannot do...
What about Exhibit A at A4440? Where you've got doctrine of equivalence, boxes, checks.
Suppose
that's pretty clear, pretty linking.
Your Honor, I believe it's totally conclusory. If you go right to that, first of all, it's not evidence. The testimony that
breaks it down by different provisions shows each limitation by limitation, a little check in each box. How more linking do you get?
Your Honor, here's all it does, though. It doesn't go back and find any evidence. It's totally conclusory. Here's what it says. First of all, Dr. Nichols, reading this slide in the little passage, it's only about 3 or 4 sentences in the whole testimony, he reads that, first of all, he refers to the accused vehicle, doesn't even say what component he's talking about. Then he starts using this pronoun it in a totally inconsistent way. He says, first of all, it provides the function that is to be provided.
So we have to decide what it means.
In this case, Your Honor, I think the problem was they didn't present anything clear.
But you've got a jury who's been listening to testimony over a lengthy period of time. Don't you think they've figured out what's under consideration and what it is?
Your Honor, I think not in this case. And just on that, there is one thing that's important. The evidence that... The other side.
You're asking us to decide that these jurors didn't know what was being talked about?
Your Honor, I think in this case that's correct.
Even when they've got an exhibit sitting in front of them with each limitation and the boxes checked and doctrine of equivalence in the big headline there?
It's not even an exhibit, Your Honor. It's a demo slide, and if you look, all it says is the accused vehicle. That's what the slide says.
Yeah, but you've not only got the jury here, as Judge Rader reviewed, but you've got the district court judge on at least 2 occasions saying this testimony is sufficient. He calls it extensive at one point, extensive testimony about DOE. So you've not only got the jury, but you've got a district, and I guess you had a motion to try to strike this testimony too when he went through it in some detail and said, it's sufficient for DOE.
No, so the testimony that's being referred to, Your Honor, was literal infringement testimony. They separated it. Dr. Nichols starts right out and he's asked, was all the testimony you said before relating to literal? Yes. Then he goes into equivalence and he has only these 3 or 4 sentences. And, Your Honor, it just simply goes through the conclusions. That's the point. He doesn't go back and link up any evidence. He never takes the evidence and comes and says, okay, here's how we proved equivalence. And that's what you have to do. What you can't do is what Pace did here. What Pace did here is they presented the case for literal infringement, and then their counsel says, in closing, we believe, ladies and gentlemen, it's absolutely positively in there, literally. But we have the doctrine of equivalence there in case you disagree with us, or in case the appellate court disagrees. It's like you can't have it as a backup compromise. If you do that, you are totally undermining the notice of claims.
Well, you're not complaining, are you, of the statement itself? Your point has to be, it must be, that statement isn't really relevant. What's relevant is whether or not there was enough expert testimony in the record to back it up, right?
No, Your Honor, we're complaining about that statement. They can't say to the jury, ladies and gentlemen, it's literal infringement, we prove literal infringement, but if you disagree with us, don't worry, you can just back it up, find equivalence, it's at least equivalence. And that's all they did. That's all they did. They then said, if you side with Pace, if you find it either literally or by equivalence, just write this down on the verdict form. And that's not sufficient under this court's precedence to make out a case for doctrine of equivalence. Even if you had literal evidence, even if you had the evidence somewhere in the literal case where they talked about function and so on, you have to link it up, you have to put it in the framework, and you have to show how that particularized evidence proves each prong of the equivalence analysis. And Your Honor, the chart and the three or four sentences.
But the left side of the figure says controllable torque transfer unit, function, way, result, check, check, check.
It's just a conclusion, Your Honor. If you look at the testimony,
the district court didn't think so. He was there too. We weren't there.
We respectfully think he erred on this point, Your Honor. What he did was he went back and said, you can find it somewhere. There's an extensive record. And this court's precedents in the Nestier, Lear-Siegler, Malta line of cases, in Texas Instruments, the most recent long discussion of this, they pointed out, even if the particularized evidence is there, you have to link it up. And in fact, it was said in that case, the evidence might have been, one of the experts in TI, his evidence might have been sufficient. I think McAllister, one of them. But the court said, you have to link it up. Because they didn't link it up and provide a separate framework for the jury. And linking it up is not just this three sentences, Your Honor.
In other words, something performs the same function by doing this, that, and the other, and it performs in the same way, and the way is such and such. That's the detail you're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor, but you also have to bear in mind, in this case, the jury found no literal infringement. So they have to say, okay, now here, if there's no literal infringement, here's the difference, here's the function of each, here's why, and you've got to refer back to the proof. You can't just have these sentences where they said, it provides the function to be provided, whatever that means. And then they say, it controls. It provides controllable and variable amounts of torque. Then he says, it controls a set of gears. That's clearly something different when they say it there. That is totally conclusory. It doesn't go back and link up any evidence. And that's why this case is totally insufficient on equivalence, we submit. Again, we would urge the court to look at the Texas Instrument case, the Malta case. If you look at and you compare the kind of evidence that was in the Malta case, where you had a complete detailed description of the accused, it was a bell ringing thing. You had a complete description there.
Now,
it was even in the patent.
Dr. Nichols is giving extensive testimony, I think you'd say, on literal infringement, right?
Correct.
And your point is, well, he doesn't make very extensive reference to the doctrine of equivalence. It's kind of a passing commentary.
It's a totally conclusory summary.
Yeah, but the question I would have is, why couldn't the jury, based on the extensive amount of discussion of literal infringement, be able to perceive a insubstantial variation from that in function, way, and result, illustrated by the fancy demonstrative exhibit? Why isn't that enough? Why isn't that linking enough? If they've done enough with the literal, the jury can figure out what's an insubstantial variation from that.
Because, Your Honor, this court has set a precedent on this because of the tension between the notice function of claims and the doctrine of equivalence to guard against just this problem of the improper compromise in which it's a second prong backup in every case. The court has said that's not enough. You can't say in the question when you're talking
but the
about
district court heard it. He said this was enough.
He did.
They heard it. They had plenty to link.
And with all due respect, we believe this is where the district court erred and did not follow this court's precedents, which say that's not enough You can't say a jury could have found equivalence evidence somewhere in the record. On equivalence, we have said, you can't do that. It's too dangerous to know dysfunction of claims. Therefore, this court has said you must, to have sufficient evidence for equivalence, put it in a framework and walk them through it. And you have to refer back to the evidence, and step by step you say, this is equivalence, it's a separate issue, it's not blurred together, where you say, like counsel said, if you find either one, just write it down. Now,
want to save the rest of your time?
Well, Your Honor, I was going to save 4 minutes. I wanted to just comment briefly on part of the cross appeal, if that's all right. I just wanted to say that to answer a few of the points in their reply brief.
Preemption.
Well, to avoid any confusion, I hope, Your Honor, the point on the literal, their appeal of literal infringement, which of course the jury found for us, and so did the district court, on literal infringement, in their main brief, we feel they were simply making the mistake of citing the testimony they like, and then ignoring the testimony that supports the verdict that we referred to. In the reply brief, they came back and said, look, we should ignore all that testimony because your guy wasn't following the claim construction. And when you walk through it, we would submit, Your Honor, that's absolutely not true. The 970 patent, controllable torque transfer unit, the judge's definition, we think too broad, but even under this definition, a multi-input device that is controlled to transfer variable amounts of torque. Our witnesses said that Planetary is not a multi-input device. MG2, the big electric motor, is like a drive shaft to the wheels. It's an output. It's not an input. And they say, well, no, wait a minute. Your guy at one point admitted that the torque was added at the ring. It's got to be an input. It's not. It's not an input because our expert explained you've got a planetary with only three things there. You've got a ring, a sun, a planet. You've got three sites. You can't have two inputs and two outputs. That's technical nonsense. And he explained that to the jury, and they were right to accept it. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Badenoch. Mr. Cordell.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Ruffin Cordell for Appley Hayes Corporation. I'd like to address the most significant issue in Toyota's appeal, which is the sufficiency of evidence under the doctrine of equivalence.
I'm going to take someplace else, Mr. Cordell. Why doesn't Gauss control this?
Gauss, Your Honor, I believe would stand.
You've got the Berman design being criticized as additional complexity, cost, and difficulty. That's what they did.
But Gauss really stands for the proposition that there may be a limitation on the doctrine of equivalence arising out of the specification, what I have come to call a specification disclaimer.
Disavowal, whatever.
Disavowal.
Sure.
We could use either.
Why didn't that happen here? Additional complexity, cost, difficulty. That's what they're doing.
There are a number of issues with the Gauss, Dawn Equipment, and SciMed line of cases. Number one is the standard of review. If we read those cases closely, I am not convinced, as Toyota argues in its brief, that this is a decision as a matter of law. What we're told in particularly Dawn Equipment is that the specification statements are facts that bear on equivalence and are used by the court in a long litany and analysis of the balance of facts in determining what is or is not an insubstantial difference. And so from that perspective, I believe that the court should first view it through the lens as a fact issue, that those facts are actually used. And the Gauss opinion itself, while I will admit, is certainly not dispositive as to whether it's a fact issue or a legal issue, the Gauss opinion itself concludes with a statement that says that, in fact, there was not sufficient evidence to support the verdict. It uses the vernacular of a fact issue. So I would make that point number one. Point number two is that if we turn...
So you're saying that the Gauss issue is subsumed back into the sufficiency of evidence
correct.
Issue?
Correct. But taking it as a legal issue, taking it as something that the court should do de novo on review, the Berman statements are at their core ambiguous. There are two statements in the patent that deal with Berman. One positive about Berman, one negative about Berman. And so right away we don't have any clarity as to whether or not a disclaimer actually occurred. And that's a very, very important point. In this case, in this court's precedent, on other disclaimers, say for literal claim scope, we have the absolute requirement that the disclaimer be clear and unmistakable. And that serves two purposes. Number one, it tells us whether a disclaimer occurred or not, which is important for the public notice function of patents. And that door swings both ways. Patentees shouldn't be surprised by the existence of a disclaimer. They should know they're making it. And number two, the scope of the disclaimer has to be clear. And that's an absolute requirement of this court's precedent with respect to disclaimers, and it should be here as well.
Mr. Cordell, I'd like to ask you about what you call a compulsory license. If a court has the authority to grant a permanent injunction and to exclude, why doesn't it have the authority to do less than that, to permit continued operation under the patent, but to impose a reasonable cost, a reasonable royalty?
Because the law simply didn't authorize the district court to do so, Your Honor.
But the law authorizes a total injunction.
Correct.
And it's equitable.
Correct.
And so why does the law have to expressly authorize something in between? Are they just permissible extremes, but nothing in between?
Well, I think that that's best viewed through the rubric of what it is the district court and really our justiciability issue here is all about, which is what is it that the district court is empowered to do to the defendant, not to the plaintiff? Because what we have here in this case, and Judge Folsom did a marvelous job with the tools he was given by the Supreme Court, but the reality is that he had to make soup out of what was served to him.
Let's look at this for a second. If he says they may continue to infringe, but I'm going to impose a royalty, right? Isn't that what happened?
Yes.
Okay. Did he retain jurisdiction of the case to make sure the royalty is paid? In that case, no final judgment, you're not here. You're going back, dismissal right now, right? No final judgment, because he's still got jurisdiction.
That's right. This is not over.
Okay. That's not what he did. Let's assume he just said, I'm giving damages based on this royalty for everything in the past. Then you're going to have to sue every 6 months in the future, right, to get recovery?
Perhaps, but I think that there's a...
Which did he do, by the way?
I'm sorry?
Which did he do, by the way? Did he give you just past damages and give us a final judgment, or are you out of here?
He gave us past damages, he gave us a final judgment, but he imposed on the plaintiff an element of his judgment in this continuing license with the expectation...
If there's a continuing license, have we got a final judgment?
I hesitate to say no, Your Honor, because I do believe that...
You want to be here. Yeah, I understand that. But the point is, do you? We've got to deal with the law. There's no final judgment if he's retained jurisdiction.
Well, one of the problems that we have with the compulsory license is that it's imperfect, and there will be issues, regardless of...
This is a big one. I'm asking you how we resolve it.
If he's retained
jurisdiction, you're out of here.
I think the way to resolve it is to recognize that he did enter a final judgment, but vacate that portion of the judgment that deals with the compulsory license as being outside the law. He simply isn't authorized to do that. We will have issues under the current regime, under the compulsory
license. So we could treat that, you're saying, as a final judgment, but then you realize you're going to have to sue them for all future enforcement of this hypothetical future royalty, which he couldn't impose because he doesn't have jurisdiction to impose it into the future.
Perhaps, but there is a middle ground in that the lawsuit has now determined the rights of the parties, and the expectation is that parties are able to work these things out. And failing that, we may have to resort to additional litigation.
But parties are presumed to obey court judgment.
Usually. it's usually a very good idea.
But I'm a little unclear. Is the view then that if any the court just cannot impose a compulsory license because there'd never be a final judgment there? I mean, that you wouldn't be able to challenge the compulsory license until it had expired? Where does this take you?
I think that as I stand and think about it, we could posit that an injunction had been entered and the court may have retained jurisdiction over its injunction, which is part of
the... Well, I think the court says the court maintains jurisdiction to enforce this portion of the final judgment. Is that kosher or not?
Again, I hadn't really considered it until Judge Rader brought it up, but the...
You can't say this is a partially final judgment, can you? You either have a final judgment on everything, or, as this court has said in its case law, you've got to go back and start over.
Well, perhaps we could view it this way. If this court does nothing and allows it to stand, I believe that Pace, my client, would be stopped from relitigating the terms of that license because it was made part of a final judgment. The difficulty is it's attempting to predict the future. And so as circumstances change, as
precisely.
The law
that's
evolves,
why we have final judgment rules.
Exactly. And I think that's why one of the rules of justiciability is that courts look to past events. We look to facts that are set.
But he says in his judgment, I'm going to retain jurisdiction over things going forward. That's not final.
But isn't that true of every injunction? When he orders an injunction and he retains jurisdiction to enforce the injunction, does that obviate the finality?
And in that case, clearly no. At least the jurisprudence has held that's entirely appropriate and, in fact, is expected. And so in this sense, I suppose, sitting in Judge Folsom's chair, he may view this as imposition of his equitable powers over time, but in a very legal remedy. He's imposed a compulsory license.
Let me ask you, I didn't see you make, it seems to me, let's assume for the sake of argument that we even reach this issue, because we'd have to affirm. You make the argument that it's not within his power and it's monetary relief. Assuming we get by all of that, do you think there's still a problem with no analysis under which we can review and whether or not he abused his discretion? In other words, from what I could find in the record, and please tell me if I'm missing something, the only reference to $25 is really one phrase, and I'm imposing $25. No discussion of why he chose that amount or felt that that was the appropriate amount. Is assuming, again, accept my argument that we've rejected all that you say about why he didn't have the authority to do this. Would you still make an argument that there's something deficient about this particular order?
I would on two grounds. Number one, he was making a fact finding, and I believe that it would be appropriate in that instance for the court to set forth the basis for that conclusion. But number two, I believe we have a Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial on that issue. What the jury in this case was told quite explicitly is that you may not award damages for future infringement. That was part and parcel of the jury instructions that were submitted to this jury. Having heard that, having heard the Georgia Pacific analysis, that is a wholly backward-looking process. Georgia Pacific, by the way, was established to settle a damages dispute that had happened in the 50s, and the case was actually decided in the 70s. It is a backward-looking analysis.
But if we accept that this is part of his equitable power, then doesn't that get rid of your Seventh Amendment money damages jury trial issue?
Except that it is fundamentally inconsistent with the long line of cases that say that when imposing damages, that is a Seventh Amendment jury issue. And so I think that while it's hard for me to articulate what the precise limits are on equitable power, I think that at some point we have to recognize that issues cross the line. And this is one of them. If there were damages to be imposed, perhaps in the future, perhaps speculative, at least a jury should have heard that issue and should have been able to pass upon those facts.
What happens if you make slight amendments in the future?
Absolutely.
To your technology?
Continuing problem. So,
does the injunction apply or not? Is there a final judgment on that? Is this a new case?
I think those are all open issues, Your Honor. I mean, for example, Toyota has announced publicly that they plan on taking this hybrid powertrain and imposing it across the entirety of their product line. And so we tried three vehicles in the case in the district court, but there are many more to come. And a significant open issue is whether the judgment automatically applies to each and every of those vehicles as we move through time.
But don't these problems potentially always arise when there's a permanent injunction? And that doesn't preclude the court from the decision from being final.
Correct, but it does mean that perhaps we will have additional litigation. So to the extent that we're looking to minimize the burdens on the district court, I don't think this does it. In fact, if anything, I think this gives every defendant an incentive to see every case all the way through trial, because the fiction is that you're going to be assessed damages according to Georgia Pacific as if you had taken a license willingly at the beginning of the process. And so why would any defendant not go ahead and press the plaintiff to its rights?
You have reserved, and you have left 3 minutes for rebuttal on your cross appeal, if there's rebuttal.
Thank you.
So you can decide what to do.
Of course, he addressed it in advance, so I think he opened your door.
Well, Your Honor, the court talked about another part of their cross appeal, so I'll respond quickly to that. Our position is, Your Honor, there is a final judgment here. And it is not uncommon that you will have a final judgment with an ongoing order. The court retains jurisdiction to enforce the order, but the judgment's final. On the royalty, if the court reaches this, which of course we think they don't need to, on the royalty, counsel's wrong to say it's backward-looking. The law of how the jury imposed the royalty, and Your Honor, the $25 comes from the jury's verdict on this. They heard all the evidence. And they came up with a damage number that both sides agree when you divide it by the vehicles, it's $25 a vehicle. So there's no dispute there. What the point is that when you fix reasonable royalty damages, you have a hypothetical negotiation. The people sit down in 2004 at the beginning of the infringement and knowing everything about future markets, scope, everything.
No, I understand that. The difficulty I'm having if we reach that and it requires our going through several steps is that the judge didn't say that. He didn't point to the testimony that would have covered the future. I mean, this compulsory license goes through the life of the patent,
right?
And the judge didn't give us any indication that there was evidence he could take the expert testimony, I assume there was expert testimony, with respect to what a reasonable royalty was for the period of infringement before trial, and extrapolate, and how he could extrapolate that particular amount of money for the rest of the life of the patent. There's no discussion of that.
Because it's the same answer, Your Honor. They decide in 2004 what a reasonable royalty is, assuming it'll go for the life of the patent. And therefore, if they sued us 10 years from now on saying it was ongoing infringement, they would be a stop to deny.
Was there a record on what basis you could set a reasonable royalty? Was that litigated?
Yes, it was, for damages. The damages came out of
But on the basis of an ongoing into the future, you can't litigate something that hasn't happened yet.
No, but the hypothetical negotiators, Your Honor, take that into account when they decide what a reasonable royalty would be.
But didn't the jury explicitly say that wasn't there something in the record that says this is not prospective? What you award is not prospective, it's for payment of the past infringement, right? There's something
Correct.
In the record in terms of what the jury concluded as being completely not prospective, right?
Correct, but only based on a reasonable royalty going forward. That was the basis for their damages. And that is in the record. There's all kinds of evidence on that. I wanted to finish one sentence I started about the equivalence of an
I always let you finish your sentence. Even short paragraphs.
When I said some of the testimonies out of sequence, and Your Honor, addressing what I say is the three or four sentences of conclusory testimony by Dr. Nichols, it comes in their brief after some cross-examination, and they say, well, against this background, everybody would know what he was talking about. But that, of course, it's not that background. That testimony comes later. The citation in the brief's wrong on that point. So at the time that he was saying this, there wasn't any linking back to any evidence. He just perfunctorily stated these conclusions without going back and getting any evidence for it. And then counsel, instead of going back...
But all that evidence back there of literal infringement and slight variations could have been in the jury's mind, right? They heard it all.
It's not enough, Your Honor, under this court's precedence if they don't walk them through. And they never did it. They did exactly the opposite. He stood up and he said, if we got, you know, it's literal, but we got this doctrine in here in case you disagree, and if you side with us, do either one. And that kind of improper compromise is exactly what we shouldn't be letting happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Badenoch. Yes, Mr. Cordell has a little time on the cross appeal.
I'll be brief, Your Honor. If I could address the calculation of damages issue, because it was very pointed in this case. The jury was specifically instructed, and the appendix site is 4389, that they were only to award damages for past infringement. They were told that you can't.
Right, but was the expert testimony, did the expert testimony in terms of what a reasonable royalty is distinguish in any way from damages for this five-year period or for the remainder of the patent?
It certainly did not focus on the future, is the short answer, because again, at the time, none of us had any notion that we were litigating a license into the future. So we didn't put any evidence in, for example, as to inflation or price changes that occur over time. One of the good facts for Toyota in this case is that they're able to actually increase prices as they introduce this hybrid drivetrain into a vehicle. Those are the kinds of facts that we would like to adduce in a future damages analysis, if that is appropriate at all. And so if you look at the Georgia-Pacific factors, they do take into account the realities of the situation, the profitability, for example, of the patented device. And what that profitability is over time is taken into account by the experts. They obviously could not use the future profitability of the of vehicles as part of the analysis that was actually presented at trial. So that did not happen. And again, another difficulty with the district court's compulsory license is that it makes no provision for inflation. Imagine the different presentation that we as a plaintiff would have made if we had known that we were going to have to face a future compulsory license. We would have to put in escalation clauses and things that, that normal licensees do to account for future infringement. It certainly was nowhere in front of us at the time. With that, I'll thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cordell. The case will be taken under advisement.